again and welcome to Musings on Golf, where great storytelling abounds today with our very special guest, Alan Shipnuck, whose brand new book, Live and Let Die, has hit the bookstores. Amazon is going to be a major seller. I'm Kelly Elbin along with Bob Bupka. Bob, we just got off talking with Alan a short time ago. What an interview that was, and our listeners are in for a real treat.
They really are. I mean, so many people have this story and that story about Liv and the PGA Tour. By Liv and Let Die, and you'll get the inside scoop from somebody that gets it better than anybody else. That's our good friend Alan Shipnuck.
Yeah, and he's really lived it. Sports writer is more closely aligned, if you will, with the back and forth between Liv Golf and the PGA Tour. Then Alan, he wrote a book entitled Phil, an Unauthorized Biography, that was very popular last year. And I think this book will follow in the same footsteps. You know, as we talked early on with him, Bob, there's still a lot to resolve between this, quote, framework that they put together. Still a lot. The only thing it seems to me that's been resolved is that the PGA Tour is not going to have to pay, these outrageous sums in lawsuits. Beyond that, Bob, I can't give you anything tangible that's really come out of it.
Yeah, but that was a major thing for the PGA Tour, that they couldn't sustain the huge amounts of legal fees that they were about to encounter. So that's step one. Let's hope that steps two, three, four, five, whatever it is, to bring peace back to professional golf can be accomplished, and accomplished quickly.
You know, Bob, we have so much to celebrate about our game, but we also have to remember those who are no longer with us. And unfortunately, we've lost two real giants in a lot of ways, in two very different ways in the golf world. The passing today of Ivor Robson, who was the voice, the starter at the Open Championship for 41 years, very distinctive Scottish accent. The tee, you say, it's Tiger Woods. That was my poor effort to do that. But he was as synonymous with the Open Championship as all the great players who played it down through the years. 41 years. You talk about a lot of wonderful memories, relationships with those players. At 83, he's gone. He will be missed, but what a legacy he leaves behind.
Really? Anybody that went to an Open Championship had the pleasure of Mr. Robson making that announcement. And he would stand at that starter's box for about 8 hours and never leave once. It was the marvel of everybody that was familiar with that statistic. How can he stay there 8 hours? But he loved it. He did it well. Matter of fact, I don't hesitate to say that there's never been a better starter in the history of golf than Mr. Robson.
No, there's no question about it. And then on Saturday, the PGA Tour let us know, unfortunately, that Andy Beam had passed away at age 70. Boy, Andy went through a lot over these last couple of years. He had a double lung transplant that he was recovering from. He had really, the lungs had been damaged badly in a battle with COVID. And talk about a gentle giant, Bob. You knew Andy well, 6'4", didn't exactly fit your prototype golfer by any means. He won 11 times on the PGA Tour, standout player at the University of Florida. You really liked Andy Beam, didn't you?
I really did. He was the heart and soul of professional golf. Nothing fancy, no airs. Andy just put his peg in the ground and did his job. And reminds me of a cute story that was told by Bev Norwood from IMG. Bev had control of the media room down at Arnold Palmer's tournament. And basically, Bev had two big jobs. One was to make sure that the pizza place in town at 6 o'clock, I'm not talking 5 after 6, I'm not talking 10 minutes to 6, I'm talking about 6 o'clock, that pizza guy better be walking in the front door of the media center bringing pizzas for members of the media. And the second most important job that Bev had, there was a gathering in the clubhouse on Saturday night for some of the media. Not everybody, some of the media. Mm-hmm. And Bev had a very distinctive style in extending that invitation. I can remember it like it was yesterday. Hey, Bob, let me ask you something. You doing anything Saturday night? No, I'm not, Bev. Could you, you don't mind coming to up at the clubhouse about 6 o'clock? We got something going. Okay, Bev, that was the invitation. But on one occasion, it happened, and Bev was an institution, believe me, out there.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Many, many years. I said, Bev, tell me the biggest surprise for you over the last 25 years of covering professional golf. He said, Bob, that's easy. He said, Seve Ballesteros learning English. Andy Bean not learning English. But he said it affectionately, and everybody loved Andy, and I actually shared that with Andy one time, and he got a big kick out of it.
He was a sweet guy, and you know, he was one of those players with those 11 wins. I think he had three runners up in major championships. I suppose if he had won one of those majors, he might be viewed differently in golf. But as a person, he'll be missed by his family, as will Ivor Robson. Hey, Bob, you know, one of the fun things about Musings on Golf is we have, you know, a lot of loyal listeners. And one of our listeners, a buddy of mine by the name of Rhett Butler, who I actually grew up playing junior golf with, has felt so strongly about what we're doing here that he's going to come on board as a sponsor with his company next week. And so pleased to have William and Harry. That's William and the word Harry .com. They're out with new golf shoes. They're gorgeous. They're suede and deer skin. They're waterproof. Looking forward to being able to tell their story starting next week.
Yeah, it's a rare combination. When you see a pair of William and Harry shoes, they're functional, but they're very stylish. And style's the name of the game nowadays. So we're proud to have William and Harry join us here on Musings on Golf. We'll have a lot of good things to say about this up-and-coming shoe company in later editions of Musings on Golf.
We sure will, and we thank Rhett and the good folks at William and Harry. And in just a moment, right after this, from our great friends at Titleist, you're going to be hearing a phenomenal interview that Bob and I did earlier today with Alan Shipnuck. Stay tuned.
Titleist is the number one ball in golf. Yes, being number one is a number, and more players trust the Pro V1 or Pro V1X than all other golf balls combined. But being number one is more than a number. It's a mindset. It's a relentless mission to design and manufacture the best performing golf balls in the game, so you can chase whatever your number one is. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Welcome back to Musings on Golf. You know, Bob, the world of golf has been forever changed with the launch of LIV Golf last year. That league's second season concludes this week in Miami. And our special guest today knows all about the battle lines drawn and perhaps some peace to be reached between LIV Golf and the PGA Tour. His new book, Live and Let Die, The Inside Story of the War Between the PGA Tour and LIV Golf, was released yesterday. And we're thrilled to have him with us today. My old friend, Alan Shipnuck, welcome to Musings on Golf. How are you?
I'm so delighted to be here. I mean, me, you, and Bob have at least 100 years in golf. Well, that's just Bob alone, but we probably have 150 combined. I mean, it's this is quite a lineup. I'm delighted.
Oh, man. Plenty to have you.
I got to offer my condolences before we begin, because we have similar situation. I see you're living in Carmel, and, you know, I was brought up in the Hamptons, and, you know, for people don't realize how tough those two locations really are.
No, the mean streets of Carmel by the sea. There's a local newspaper called the Carmel Pine Cone. It comes out every Friday, and I run to pick up a paper copy because they will literally have stories about cats being rescued out of trees. And it's the bubble of all bubbles. I'm happy to be there. There's a lot of nice golf nearby, but I recognize it's not the real world.
Carmel Pine Cone. That's awesome.
There's a coffee shop in the middle of town, isn't there, in Carmel?
There's a handful. Yeah. It's big coffee culture. Everyone, you know, it's a lot of people go to take their dog, grab a cup of coffee on Ocean Avenue, walk down to the beach. It's very quintessential. Yeah.
The reason I mentioned a coffee shop, when I was out there covering the U.S. Open, I went to the coffee shop and I saw this huge guy sitting in the corner stool. And come to find out, he was the owner of a local cigar store. But that was his that was his place at this counter. So the next day, I made sure I got there about 10 minutes early, and I wanted to see his reaction. So I sat in his seat. Well, number one, everybody in the place froze. The owner froze as the door opened, and the cigar man came in. And he just walked behind me. He goes, I said, okay, I'll give you a seat back. You scared me. Don't worry about that.
Yeah, always causing trouble, Bob. I can
the rabble rouser, Bob Bupka, right?
No way. Well,
and John Madden, the great Raiders coach, and of course beloved TV commentator, was a Carmel guy, and he went to the same coffee shop every day, and he was a local institution. People would see him, and he would chat with whomever, and I mean, he was there basically 7 days a week. So there are regulars, and as long as no uppity out of towners come and steal their seat, everything remains harmonious.
But exactly.
Well, I'd never do it again, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, we've got so much to cover here. The present. So to start with, what's the current situation right now in terms of negotiations between LIV Golf and the PGA Tour? And can you pull your crystal ball out for a second? Do you have any sense of how this is all going to play out?
It's a mess. I was just talking a couple days ago. I'm going to post at some point today a story on firepitcollective.com where all my writing appears that gets into all these issues. It's just been very busy with the publication of the book. But I was just talking to a New York money guy who's integral to these negotiations. And I asked him, is this thing going to be done by December 31st, which is supposed to be the deadline for it to consummate the framework agreement? He's like, not a chance. Like, it's just the cast is too big. You have the PGA Tour, the European Tour, you have the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia. Each of those organizations has a lot at stake, has a lot of ego. They have a lot of lawyers and advisors. And then now, as you guys have probably read, the framework agreement, there was nothing binding in it. So there was a line in there about Saudi Arabia or the Public Investment Fund would have the first right of refusal for any outside investment. But that was like a pinky promise. That wasn't a deal. That wasn't a contract. And so other people in the financial world, mostly private equity, but some other types of money have recognized that this deal is wide open. They're trying to get in on it. And they could come in alongside the Public Investment Fund, or they could try and push them out entirely. And so for the PGA Tour, it would make sense if they can bring in some US-based investment, dilute the Saudis' equity and influence. And that'd make it much more palatable to the players. And of course, to lawmakers on Capitol Hill who've been scrutinizing this whole arrangement. But will, Yasir and the other top Saudi guys, they don't take a minority position in anything. When they invest, they come in heavy, they have total control. And so this is why it's grinding on, because now, instead of just having a three-legged stool with PGA Tour, European Tour, Public Investment Fund, now you've got 10 other people or 10 other entities vying to be part of it. So if I had to guess, I think that they will consummate this deal with the Public Investment Fund and maybe one other outside investment that has a small stake. But then at least optically, you can say the Saudis are just investors along with one of these other Silver Lake Capital or Endeavor, or these other big U.S. companies. And I think it becomes a much easier sell to Congress. And that's an important part of this.
Does LIV Golf at some point go away if that all happens?
Yeah, it's a fundamental question. I mean, they're certainly going to play a full schedule in 2024. And, the schedule's not final, but it's starting to leak. And it looks like, eight of the events are going to be international, only six in the U.S. Like, they're really, that's where they've had success. When they went to Australia, they went to Singapore, huge crowds, a lot of media attention. When they go to Arizona and Florida, nobody cares. Like, they have to stay away from the PGA Tour stronghold. And so the LIV is leaning into that international aspect. And that argues for its long-term viability. if all of this for Saudi Arabia is a combination of trying to sports wash its reputation and colonize new markets to, from a business standpoint, then if you can go to Singapore, you can go to Korea, you can go all these countries, and bring this roadshow, it has a lot of value to them. And, you know, I get into all this stuff in the book, but, you know, Vision 2030, which is Mohammed bin Salman's vision to reshape the Saudi economy and really its society. Two of the pillars are sports and tourism. And, you know, golf marries those in a unique way. And so even if this deal gets done and the Public Investment Fund is essentially underwriting the PGA Tour, Yasir could decide to keep LIV going as a parallel entity. And he's going to decide the future of LIV Golf. It's not going to be Jay Monahan. It's not going to be Jimmy Dunn or Tiger Woods or Rory McIlroy or anyone else on the PGA Tour board. I mean, it's Yasir's baby. He controls the purse strings. And if he feels like it has value for the Public Investment Fund and for the Saudi regime and for his very demanding boss, MBS, then he can keep it going as long as he wants. But how the deal gets done and what the Public Investment Fund's role is and how big a voice Yasir has, that will certainly play a factor in LIV's longevity.
Let me ask you this. When LIV first burst onto the scene, the popular cry that I heard was, well, it's going to be a temporary thing. They're not making any money. They're going to run out of money. I mean, in reality, that's the furthest thing from the truth. There's no way they're going to run out of money.
That's true. I mean, Yasir runs the PIF, and his very demanding boss has given him a mandate to grow its assets to $1 trillion by 2025. So what they're spending on LIV is, you know, essentially a rounding error. But these guys, despite the narrative, do not burn up money. I mean, they've grown the fund so big because they are cold, calculating, ruthless businessmen. So they would like a return on the investment. And it was always going to be through selling the franchises. You know, they have this vision of selling the franchises for $500 million each. There's 12 of them. So you do the math, that's $6 billion. They would get their money back and get a nice profit. And the longer LIV endures, the bigger they can grow its fan base, the more they can reach these international markets, the better the chance they have of actually selling the franchises and creating some value. So it's not about running out of money. It's about running out of patience, you know, and expedience. If they feel like LIV is served as an ends to a mean, which was to get Saudi Arabia a seat at the table of global golf and to give them a leadership position and to be embraced by corporate America. And if LIV is creating obstacles to that, if it feels like a competitor to this new entity that they're investing in, then maybe they will de-emphasize it. But it has strategic importance to the Saudi regime. It has emotional weight to Yasir. I mean, this was his baby. All these players bought into his vision, validated it. He's very close personal friends with Bryson, with Brooks. You've never seen a happier guy than Yasir Al-Rumayyan playing in the LIV Pro-Am. He jumps in his cart. He plays, you know, two holes with Bryson and gets a tip on how to hit longer drives. And he buzzes over and plays like three holes with Phil. He gets a chipping lesson. Then he goes and plays a few holes with Cam Smith, gets a putting lesson. Then he goes and he bros up with Brooks Koepka. It's like fantasy camp for a golf nerd, which is what he is. And so as long as Yasir is happy and as long as he feels like he and his interests are getting value, then LIV can stick around as long as he wants it to.
When I look back, that secret meeting that the tour had that really irked all of the players, I think they came up with one word that tried to gloss everything over. It wasn't an agreement. It was framework. You know, I had never heard the word framework mentioned so much as I did following that meeting with LIV and the PGA Tour.
Yeah, because they're miles from an actual deal. And so they had to call it something. I mean, you could have called it, hopes and dreams, because that's really all it is. It's not a deal. It had importance to the tour because the only thing concrete that has been accomplished so far is the dismissal of the lawsuits with prejudice, so they can't be refiled. That alone was a huge victory for the PGA Tour because their legal fees were $5 to $10 million a month. they were burning up their reserves just paying the lawyers. And you know, this idea that they wanted to depose Yassir as part of these lawsuits, and that had already gone to the Ninth Circuit Court, that was certainly headed to the Supreme Court. That would have taken years to play out, and that's thousands and thousands of billable hours. And for the PGA Tour to at least stop the hemorrhaging, that was a big part of why they even came to the table. Now, if they can get this deal done, that's a bonus. But it's very clear that the PGA Tour, its old-fashioned not-for-profit model, is going to change no matter what. And either the money is going to come from the Saudis, or it's going to come from New York-based private equity firms. It might come from Silicon Valley. But either way, they're going to get the neighborhood of $2 billion of investment. And so now they can, you know, Jay Monahan wrote a bunch of checks with his mouth that he can't cash with the tour reserves. Like all these promises for the elevated purses, the sponsors were balking. They were starting to walk away. The tour was not going to be able to pay the players what they'd promised. So this money, whether it's Saudi or it's American, will allow the tour to fulfill its promises. So in some ways, this whole labored process will have been worth it. They got rid of the lawsuits, and they're going to get billions of dollars of investment to secure the tour's future. But it's certainly been a tumultuous and chaotic period for the game.
Just pleased to be joined on Musings on Golf by Alan Shipnuck of the Fire Pit Collective, the author of the new book, Live and Let Die, the inside story of the war between the PGA Tour and LIV Golf. Hey, Alan, you know, Jay Monahan has taken a lot of barbs, and I think rightfully so. If you go back to the initial, correspondence, it's my understanding that LIV Golf tried to reach out to the tour. Did the tour simply miscalculate and underestimate LIV Golf from the outset?
That would be a kind way of putting it. I mean, that, you know, one of the things I want to do with this book is to bring everything out into the sunlight, because this whole story has happened in the shadows. Every handshake deal, every negotiation, every betrayal, every time the money moves around, there was never a press release. There was never a press conference, and people have not gotten the whole story. And so I think in some ways it's the emotional highlight of the whole book is in 2021, I go through the whole history of the Premier Golf League, right? And that was where this idea began. And then they brought on the Saudis as investors. And then Monahan swooped in, created that strategic alliance between the European Tour and the PGA Tour. That killed the Premier Golf League. He masterfully undermined the PGL. But then the ripple effect was the Saudis said, you know, we don't need these guys. We can go at it alone. And they decided to go all in on golf. But before they blew everything up, you know, their number two guy, Majed Al Saroor, he sent a letter to Monahan and said, this is in April 2021, said, you know, we want to partner with the tour. We want to invest in the tour. Let's sit down and talk about the possibilities. And there's two people on the planet who have a copy of that letter, and I got my hands on it. And it's really a fundamental document in this whole story, because Monahan never responded. Not only that, he went into a board meeting of the tour and said, we are at war. You know, he said, these guys are trying to come in, put us out of business and destroy the golf ecosystem. We are at war. And that set the whole tone for this divisive, combative era in professional golf. If Jay Monahan had a time machine, I think there's zero doubt he would pick up his phone and he'd call Majed and try and bring them into the fold. I mean, that was before LIV Golf had really any foothold. They didn't have any commitments. Like Jay could have had the Saudi money without any of this divisiveness. But you know, he's an old college hockey player, and around PGA Tour headquarters, the dark side of Monahan's personality is called Hockey Jay. And it was like he felt like he was there in the corners trying to muck out a puck, and he just started throwing blows. And that pugnacious attitude did not serve him well when compromise and being a little more conciliatory could have altered professional golf's, you know, trajectory. But that's the decision Monahan made, and he's had to live with the repercussions ever since. And as you said, Kelly, like a lot of the criticism is valid, because, and then, you know, he went all in on demonizing the Saudis and their money. It was a choice. It was a tactic. And he brought the 9/11 families into the conversation. And when you do that, it becomes a lot harder than turn around and cut a deal with them because you look like such a hypocrite. You know, instead of this being a professional battle, he made it personal. And I understand why. He was outgunned. He felt like, you know, the moral high ground was all he really had. And on some level, it's true. But that was a choice that he has to live with now.
And, you know, when I got the copy of the book and I started reading it, I paused and reflected. And I said, why is Alan so qualified to write this book? And, you know, from all my years out there and watching you with players and the respect you have a unique combination of confidence of the players, but a little intimidation they feel from you. And, you know, that makes for good writing.
Well, I appreciate that, Bob. And, you know, it was interesting. You probably saw on social media, Justin Thomas came after me after we put the excerpt out. And his critique was, you know, that, you know, he was tired of me writing stories that are not flattering about golf. And I've done millions of those. I love telling underdog stories. I've written about so many heroic guys who have made their lives in golf. And I've written about all these wonderful destinations and the joys of playing golf with your friends with the, you know, the sun on your back. Like, I've celebrated all these virtues, but we're in the middle of the most contentious period in the history of professional golf. And it is not my role to sanitize things. And, you know, what Justin wants is public relations. He doesn't want journalism. And so to your point, Bob, like, I felt like the relationship that I value the most is with the reader. It's not with the players. And it's a very sacred trust. Like, they count on me to tell it like it is. And to, as I said earlier, so much of the story has been unknown. So I had to get in there and dig around, and it explodes some of the official version that Justin Thomas has been fed by Jay Monahan and Jimmy Dunn. And so they don't like that I'm bringing to light the missteps of the tour and the deception and the betrayal, but that's really a Justin Thomas problem. It's not mine. Like, the fans have a right to know what's really happened in this story. And so, yeah, I knew there was going to be some blowback, but I'm at peace with it because I tried to be very fair to both sides and tell the complete story. And I didn't impose my own views or my own beliefs. I really tried to stay just right down the middle and let the reader decide how they feel about this. And I hope people will come to it with an open mind, because symptomatic of modern life in America, like, everyone picks sides very quickly. You're pro-Liv, you're pro-tour. And there was a lot of shouting and name calling, and people had to sort of defend their positions. But I try and offer some counter narratives and some new information that might nudge people to think about these events a little differently. And this is not the bland, sanitized version of golf that Justin Thomas wants. I mean, this was a spicy moment for the game. There was a lot of hard feelings. There was a lot of bitterness and anger and controversy and energy. And it's all captured in the pages of this book.
You know, if the phone rings in my house and Janice says, "It's Alan on the line. He wants to talk to you," I'm going to run for the hills because I'd be a nervous wreck.
and that's fair. I mean, players always have the option of not answering the questions. But what I found in doing this book was that everybody wanted to talk to me because there was so much at stake here from a legacy standpoint and a reputational standpoint. And now some folks, because of the delicacy of what they were telling me, you know, I had to grant them anonymity. But the players wanted this story told, but they wanted their version of it. So I was always, you know, I was traveling on two passports between LIV Golf and the PGA Tour, and I was always toggling back and forth and trying to ascertain, you know, what was spin, what was truth, the constant fact checking and cross checking. It was a very unique challenge.
A unique challenge, and you had such a cast of characters involved here, and certainly Phil is right at the top. That tipping point of his calling you and the quote about the scary, you know what's, you know, you wrote a very popular book, unauthorized biography called Phil. Wasn't the fact of the matter, when he said that to you, he was well on his way, even at that point, of recruiting players to leave the PGA Tour. I mean, he really had already, you know, reset or set where he was taking his future as far as his week-to-week play away from the PGA Tour.
Bill is such a fascinating character, and I learned a lot about his role in the creation of the breakaway leagues, reporting this most recent book. And I didn't want to go too deep on Phil because I didn't want to feel like a sequel to his biography, but he makes some hilarious cameos in this narrative. And the short version is he was the biggest advocate for the Premier Golf League, and he was recruiting players, and he picked up the phone and called Keith Pelley and told him to cut a deal with the PGL and not the PGA Tour. But as soon as the PGL lost momentum, Phil went all in with the Saudis. But at the same time, he kind of took all the ideas and all the conversations, and he tried to create his own breakaway league funded by Silver Lake Capital, this big private equity firm in New York. And all the while, he's negotiating with Jay Monahan and Ed Early in case he stayed on the PGA Tour. And so he's trying to advocate for better working conditions. He was working four sides of the street simultaneously. It's unbelievable. I mean, all roads ran through Phil on this whole tale, and to tease it out and to bring this to light was, I mean, you have to laugh. Like, the guy is such a muckraker. He's in the middle of everything, and he's just constantly stirring the pot, which I love. I mean, it's part of why Phil is so compelling. But if you were one of a Premier Golf League loyalist, and all of a sudden he switches sides, and then if you're a Saudi guy and you realize that he's negotiating with other people at the same time, like, it was very sneaky. But on some level, Phil's been vindicated. I mean, one of his primary critiques was the tour was sitting on too much money and not paying the players enough. Turns out to be true. He wanted the players to have more of a say in governance. Now we're seeing the ramifications of that not having happened previously, where Monahan and Jimmy Dunn did this end around. And so now the players have taken back more control of the tour. Like, all these things are what Phil was advocating for. So it came at a high reputational cost. Like, he kind of set himself on fire, but in a lot of ways, yeah, Phil was right.
Hey, you've mentioned a couple of times the Premier Golf League. I'm wondering, just for our listeners, Alan, could you explain a little bit about who Andrew Gardner was and the Premier Golf League was? That was the idea, right, that LIV ultimately took, essentially, correct?
It's incredible. I mean, in some ways, like, this book is the biography of an idea. And it was Andy Gardner who had the idea. He was a London lawyer who was an obsessive golf fan. And like a lot of us who watch a lot of golf, he was disenchanted by the product. It was kind of stale, kind of tired, kind of bloated. And so he felt like there was a better way to present professional golf on TV, streaming platforms, in person. Started talking to stakeholders in the game, including Rory McIlroy, including Keith Pelley of the European Tour. And he ultimately produced this 116-page, painstakingly detailed prospectus of a breakaway tour, what it could look like. And it was called the Premier Golf League. But Andy Gardner was an idealist. He was not a closer, and he couldn't get the deal done. But his idea is what the Saudis cut and pasted the whole thing into LIV Golf. And so it's tracing that history. I learned a lot, and it's one of the themes that runs through this book is when the idealists meet the money men, the idealists get crushed. It happened to Rory McIlroy, you know, on some level, it happened to Greg Norman in 1994. He had this world tour idea, and Fincham came in and completely outfoxed, outmaneuvered, and humiliated him. Like, the idealists don't fare well. And but the Premier Golf League is fundamental to this whole story. Like, they began this entire notion of a breakaway league.
Joining us is Alan Shipnuck, author of a wonderful book, and you have to read it if you have any interest in golf at all. It's called Live and Let Die. He's with us on Musings on Golf. Completely hypothetical question, Alan. Had Greg Norman won the Masters and been part of the club, would LIV Golf still have happened with Greg as its biggest proponent?
You're referencing that was a Peter Jacobson quote in the foreword of the book. And it's fascinating because by any measure, whether it's trophies, dollars, world ranking points, Ferraris, I mean, Greg Norman has had a spectacular life. He's done it all. But there is like this hole within him that can never be filled. And LIV Golf is an expression of that. Like, he needs the adulation, he needs the validation, he needs to be celebrated as this agent of change. And in a lot of ways, he's like Phil Mickelson in these regards. And so, yeah, if Norman had won the Masters and a half dozen other of the majors he kicked away, maybe he would just be sitting on his yacht and we would never heard of LIV Golf. It's entirely possible, because you know Norman charmed and sort of seduced Yasir and Majed and these top Saudi guys, and he helped them find this vision of what LIV could be. It wasn't like they had the idea and then they just hired Norman. Like, he was in on the ground floor. So he sold them this world tour idea. They were dazzled by his star power and his celebrity, and there's no question he helped launch the whole thing. So it's a great thought exercise. You know, if Greg Norman had a green jacket, his whole life would be different and his whole legacy would be different. And he may not have wanted to risk it all with LIV Golf, but that's just not the way it's played out.
You get a kick out of this, Alan. Greg Norman was very inconsistent during the years I was out there. I mean, one day I'd ask him if he had time and he'd be very gracious. The next day he'd say he's way too busy. And then one time I really needed something. I said, Greg, I only need you for a minute or two. And he said, I don't have any time, Bob. I said, gee, thanks, Greg, because Jack Nicklaus is waiting for me and I didn't want to hold him up any longer.
That is so satisfying. Well, everyone saw that photo of him looming over my shoulder like the Grim Reaper at the first Live London tournament. The next tournament they had was in Portland, and we had a meeting in the mines in the parking lot, and we talked for half an hour, and he apologized, and I told him that I wanted to write about the world tour, and he said he had boxes of documents that he had saved for 30 years about the tour's duplicity and betrayal, and he promised to let me see them, and in the end he reneged. And I picture Norman rattling around his house at midnight, sometimes opening those boxes and sifting through them, you know, looking for this validation that will never come. And he's a fascinating character. You know, he gets a long chapter in this book about his life and times, because it's so fundamental to the story. And, you know, I have some empathy. Like, when one of the most poignant parts of the whole book is, you know, he has this super complicated relationship with his dad, Greg Norman does. And that's kind of what drives him to achieve, to prove to his dad he's not a failure. And after the 96 Masters, when he's just, you know, suffered the worst meltdown in golf history, basically. And of course, Faldo gives him that big hug on the last green and whispers in his ear. And, you know, Norman told the confidant afterwards, like, that was the most meaningful hug of my life. And, you know, my dad never hugged me when I was a boy. And it's like, man, you read that and you realize like how screwed up this guy is on some fundamental level. And that all the trophies and all the fancy cars and all the headlines can never fill that void. And so, what I like about this book is that the characters are complex. You know, they're not black and white. And like, you know, like Yasir would make a good bad guy, because he's got all the money and all the influence and he's kind of this shadowy figure from the other side of the world. But in fact, he loves golf as much as any of us do. And he believes in its virtues and he believes that it can be a force for good in a society. And he wants golf to become part of the fabric of Saudi Arabia. And he's a true believer. Now, is he trying to advance the goals of the Saudi regime? Clearly. Is he very loyal to his boss, Mohammed bin Salman, who is a scary mofo, as Phil Mickelson rightfully pointed out? Yes. I mean, so he's complex and he's layered, and everyone in the story is the same way, including Greg Norman, including Roy McIlroy, Tiger Woods. Like, they're such compelling figures, and it's because they're complicated and they're contradictory that I think they're really fascinating.
Couple more questions with our very special guest, Alan Shipnuck. Are we done at this point in terms of top PGA Tour players leaving for LIV, or is that money, that newfound money, those $20 million purses, the fact that I can still get my world golf ranking points, is that keeping, whether it's a Cantlay, a Schauffele, whoever it might be, is that keeping him on the PGA Tour as opposed to running off to LIV?
Well, that's why there's a lot at stake for the PGA Tour to consummate this framework agreement with the Saudis as part of it. Because if they push them aside because of optics, because of pressure, because of ego, whatever it is, and Liv goes back to being a direct competitor to the PGA Tour, and now Yasir's pissed off and he wants to bring out the checkbook again, that's a big risk for the PGA Tour. And you know, one of the things I uncovered in reporting this book is, you know, Patrick Cantlay turned down $75 million from Liv. It's part of why he's so spicy about all of this stuff and why he's so obsessed with the money. So if they come back around, you know, Jay Monahan and Jimmy Dunn said, hey, we like these guys. They're good guys. Their money's clean. They're part of the family now. So the barrier to going to Liv has been lowered for the players because their own leadership, you know, they feel like the players feel like they were betrayed by their leadership. And the leadership embraced these other guys. So I think that if they go back into the old way of doing things where they're competing, a lot of guys will go to Live. I really believe that. But the question becomes, does that change anything? Like, just let's say that Live signed Cantlay and Shoffley, who you mentioned. Let's throw in, I don't know, Will Zalatoris. Let's throw in Adam Scott. Pick five or six other players you care about.
Sure.
Does that change anything? Like, are people going to run to the CW to watch the tournaments? I don't know. I mean, the core of the PGA Tour is Tiger Woods, even in his reduced role. It's Rory McIlroy. It's Jordan Spieth. It's Jon Rahm. And it's Justin Thomas. Like, those guys move the needle. And I don't think they're going anywhere. And everyone else is just filler in some way. And you know, the tour can lose a Cantlay and they can plug in an Aubert and they'll just keep going. So I don't think that now, if all of a sudden Liv Golf has 2/3 of the top 20 players in the world, no matter, you know, by the eye test, if not the world ranking, then maybe that changes the calculus. But because, you know, the stewards of the world ranking have aligned against Liv again, it's a big risk. You know, if say you're an Aubert and you're getting offered $100 million to go in this new era on the PGA Tour, you can make that money if you play well, and you can definitely play in the majors. And if you're a young, ambitious player, I mean, look at Taylor Gooch. He may get frozen out of the majors. He's probably one of the 10 best players in the world right now, but we have no way of knowing because he may not play in the majors. And so it is a big risk for a young player. You know, Brooks, Bryson, Phil, DJ, Bryson, they're exempt into the majors because of what they've done in the past. But these young guys, it's a roll of the dice. And even someone like Cantlay, you know, if you haven't won a major, your pathway back into them goes quickly. So it's a fascinating question. We're going to have to see how it plays out with this framework agreement, and then we'll know.
Alan, let me ask you this. In your opinion, what should Jay Monahan had done at the outset?
Well, he should have had the conversation. He could have done what he's trying to do now, but 3 years ago, say, you know what? Whatever our personal feelings about Saudi Arabia as a political entity, their money is a part of the global financial system, and they are a part of our life. And everyone knows they've invested in Uber and in Boeing and in Tesla and everything, and a bunch of other publicly traded companies. And Saudi money is just here. So how can we use it to benefit a proud institution like the PGA Tour? And instead of demonizing him, he could have partnered with them and this whole story would have gone away. Now, I'm glad he chose the route he did, because otherwise there'd be no book, you know. But, you know, it was a fatal misstep. And I understand, you know, it's an emotional issue. And he reacted like a lot of people do. It's sort of this knee-jerk distaste. But he has a fiduciary duty to think about his players and think about his tour. And I don't think he did that at the outset. Now he's trying to make up for it and he's paddling hard to get this deal done, but it's coming at a great cost to his tour, to his personal reputation, and to golf fans who have, you know, had to suffer through this extremely divisive period.
To that point, has the game suffered in terms of how it's viewed by the public? In other words, can this game sustain itself long-term with two competing tours?
There's not enough star power to support two tours. There's not even enough to support one, you know, as it's configured now. You have 48 events on the PGA Tour. You know, half of them are kind of turkeys because the top players skip them. I mean, what LIV has gotten right is all your players have to show up at all the tournaments. And that's what the tour is trying to do with this, with the elevated events, but they chickened out very quickly. And
yeah, they did.
You know, we'll see what, you know, Pebble Beach in 2024 is going to be fascinating because it's elevated. It's still going to have an amateur component, even though it's de-emphasized. And all these players, are they going to turn up to support the tour and support this great old event? Or are they going to, they're going to complain about the weather or a few bumpy greens and skip it. And we'll see how entitled they really are because the tour has blown up its entire structure to cater to them, these huge purses. And if they don't support the Crosby clam bake, it's going to be a real indictment of their priorities. So, but yeah, I think that some fans have been turned off by this whole period. I know that to be the case because I see it on social media and I interact with golf fans every day, but it's repairable. I mean, the best case scenario is that the framework agreement gets consummated and we finally get a true global schedule. You take the 12 best tour events, you take five or six of the best European tour events, you take a handful of LIV events, and all the top players have to play in them. And they go, and you can make the Australian Open one of those. You can make the Scottish Open, these proud old tournaments that have withered and suffered, get all the best players there, get them all to move all around the world, have some team component, which I actually enjoy. I mean, we don't need 72 holes of stroke play week after week. That's such a slog, you know. All the best players go to these events, and then we'll finally have a schedule that makes sense instead of tours competing with each other, bring the game back together in a cohesive, you know, really fun, dynamic way. So that would be the best case outcome. And there's still a lot to get done between now and then, but that could be the payoff to golf fans who have had to kind of endure all the press conference bitchiness and all the name calling and frankly, like, you know, tournaments without your stars, because we were talking earlier, you know, Pebble Beach is my hometown event, and for years it only got three big names: Jordan, who's an AT&T guy, so he shows up, and then you got Phil and Dustin, and they losing Phil and Dustin was a huge blow to the tournament. And there's a lot of other events that have lost players who matter, and so, you know, the tournaments have suffered, the fans have suffered. Like, it would be great if we can bring the game back together in a cohesive way, but I'm an idealist. And as we said, we know what happens to idealists in this scenario. So we have to see how it plays out.
Final question from me, Alan. Did your opinions of anyone in this drama change at all from writing this book?
Many people. I mean, I learned so much, and this became a real, this whole controversy became a mirror, you know, it became a Rorschach test, and it revealed so much about so many. So my opinions of some folks were elevated and some were diminished. You know, money is a great clarifying force. And we saw how the corrosive power of money, you know, it came flooding into this sport like never before. And lives were changed and reputations were shattered. And it's just been interesting. You know, a guy like John Rahm was certainly elevated. He's been so classy throughout. And he said, you know, when they said, well, do we need to pay you more money to make up for saying no to Liv, he said, hey, I'm doing fine. I'm doing great. Don't worry about me. You know, like, he has a real perspective, but you know, we've certainly seen a lot of other players go that direction. So yeah, it's, I don't want to tip my hand. I'm going to leave it to the readers to ascertain, but it's, I will say that the Liv era has been very revealing.
Live and Let Die. If you see it in your favorite bookstore, Amazon, anywhere, buy it. You'll be thanking me for doing that. It's the inside story of war between the PGA Tour and LIV Golf. Alan Shipnuck, thank you so much for your valuable time. Good luck with the book. I already know it's going to be a huge success.
Well, thanks for having me, guys. This was super fun, and I appreciate your time. It's fun to reconnect. So let's do it again soon.
Your most important shot is the one you're about to hit. And whether it's the first drive of the day, a difficult approach from a tight lie, or a bunker shot to save par, you need to know your golf ball will perform exactly the way you need it to. Superior performance on every type of shot. It's why the majority of the world's best players choose the Pro V1 or Pro V1X, and why you should too.
Well, Bob, there's still obviously a lot to be played out with LIV Golf and the PGA Tour. No one has been closer to it and reported on it like Alan Shipnuck. Incredible views that he has. Really a pleasure to listen to him. I think our viewers got learned a lot from that interview.
Yeah, he's one of the rare individuals covering golf that has the inside information, but probably more importantly, he has the talent to deliver that in the form of a book. So LIV and Let Die, absolutely a must read for anybody interested in the world of professional golf.
No question about it. We wish him very, very well with the sales of the book. We thank Alan Shipnuck for joining us. Next week, Michelle McGann, multiple winner on the LPGA Tour, fashion conscious with the fantastic hats, and just a delightful person. Looking forward to talking to Michelle next week. My buddy Bob Bupka, this has been a real treat. Thanks for joining us. I'm Kelly Elvin signing off. Musings on Golf.